nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, a very pleasant good morning to you. Hi there, this is Patrick Timpone, and it would be the 9th of June, 2021. You're going to meet Fred Dashefsky with the Real World of Money. Fred wasn't able to make it last week. We generally have him on the first Wednesday of the month, but so he's here on the second Wednesday. And Jet Blake is going to be here. He's a kind of a social commentator. So we're going to comment on the social aspect of the United States of America. And we'll do that in a couple of hours. Stephanie Seneff and her partner in a white paper on these jabs, we also known as vaccines, but they're not a vaccine, technically, legally, lawfully, or anything else. They're just an injection. And she's going to be here next week. Also, Suchard Bhakti has agreed to come back on, and that's going to be probably next week as well. We have Richard Massey, Ray Pete. Oh, that's the following week, right? Yeah, man, I don't even know what week I'm on. Oh, Matthew Arrett is on next week, and Matthew's a great researcher out of the UK, and he's got some really spooky, interesting things to talk about this whole transhumanism thing and how far back it goes, and this will kind of float your boat when you find out how long this stuff has really been planned, which is, I mean, you can't even make it up. So, we have a lot of things coming up here. Richard Massey and Ray Pete will be here on the 21st. Richard Mayberry, too, the last Wednesday of the month. And Dr. Jennifer Daniels and some of our other regulars. Fred Dashefsky's a good friend. He's has a great little company here called U.S. Coin Capital. Fred is in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Or is it North Carolina? Is it South Carolina? I never get that right. South Carolina.
It is South Carolina.
South Carolina. Fred buys and sells gold coins for a living with U.S. Coin Capital. He's a Numismatist. Could you even spell it when you became one, or did you just become one?
I did, yeah. I learned it right away. You know, numismatics and numismatists, so we just had to kind of get used to it. So
yeah.
It's kind of fun when people say, what do you do? And I say, I'm a numismatist, and they say, oh, you're a doctor.
Oh, you're a doctor. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, I'm a doctor. I don't do insurance, but I'm a doctor. Tell folks what a numismatist is. Tell them what it is.
A numismatist, the numismatics, the study of coins and currency. A numismatist would be someone who is, relatively an expert in that field, which I guess after 36 years, I have achieved that status, so happily so. Done an awful lot of research to get there. But yeah, numismatics, the study of coins and currency, you know, which is a fascinating subject to me as I was a young pup growing up and, you know, watched America go off a gold and silver standard that apparently had been good enough since the 1790s. But somehow in my lifetime, they suddenly decided, you know, this was no longer necessary. And I found that kind of troubling.
And that was that in the Nixon move in 71, Fred, or the original one at 33? Would that be when the big one?
Well, I wasn't around at 33. So, yeah.
But that's when we technically went off, though, right? For the first time.
Yeah, there was a kind of a series of events. So 33 ended the production of American gold coins, although we would continue to make silver coins until 1964. But 1933 ended the production. In fact, you sent me that article. Of course, I was aware of the sale of that famous coin from 1933 because in 1933, as the last of the $20 gold coins were minted, the recall order from President Roosevelt came down to the general public outlawing America's private ownership of gold, which would remain that way until 1971. So for about 45 or so years, it was illegal in America for American citizens to own physical gold.
Really?
And while the production of gold coins had begun in January of 33, the recall order came down almost immediately. So all of the 1933 $20 gold coins that were minted were not supposed to be released by the mint into circulation. They were all supposed to have been melted and destroyed.
I see.
We found out historically, decades later, that a few of them escaped, and they would start to show up here and there.
And that puppy sold for $20 million at Sotheby's.
$19.5 million.
Wow. So So Roosevelt.
Well, I remember the last time it showed up. We had gone to the auction. I want to say it was around 2000, and at that point, it was a $5 million sale, and they'd estimated years later it would be worth 10 or 12, and here it's sold now for almost $20 million.
Oh, so you and Andy saw this same coin 20 years ago, and it was sold for $5 million, and 20 years later, it sells for 19.5, $20 million.
Incredible, isn't it?
What's up with that? I mean, well, how can coin just all of a sudden increase in value by $15 million in 20 years? Explain how that's why that even, just because it's the only one, just rare.
Well, there's a couple of variables that are at play here. First of all, it is one of one, right? Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the ultimate in rarity. This is the kind of thing that, I used to say Warren Buffett. I guess we have to modernize our references now. So Jeff Bezos. Elon Musk, if they wanted to buy it, they still couldn't get it because there's still only one. So it's not a function of whether you have the money. Hmm. And again, the Treasury went through a pretty significant series of events when that one sold 20 years ago, because there were a lot of legal issues about whether or not it should be even available to be sold, because in theory, these were all supposed to have been melted and recalled. And there was some legal argument that it belonged to the Treasury and it didn't belong to the private party that was trying to sell it.
Right.
It had actually gone out of the United States. It was in the hands of the King of Egypt, King Farouk, for years, eventually came back into the U.S. and then it was marketed. And after all the legal maneuvering was done, the Treasury did announce that this one coin would be legalized. And after the sale, I believe it was $5.1 million, they literally took $20, it was like $19 and change, off of the top of the deal and put that into the U.S. Treasury Department to legally pay them.
It's a $20. Well, Freddie, let's go back to Roosevelt. So I don't quite understand why the Mint, were they that much of a disconnect between the president and the Treasury at that time? They were beginning to print coins, gold coins again in 33, and then he calls in gold and makes it illegal. So evidently, they didn't know what each other were going to do? Or do we know the history behind that?
The Treasury was simply behind the curve. I don't know how quickly the decision was made, but it became substantially evident that we were at a critical juncture in America coming out of the Great Depression. The resolution for the Great Depression was a kind of a project that the government offered to the general public, and basically it said, look, we can help resolve this economic disaster if you are willing to allow us to take back your private gold and replenish our vaults, which are now depleted of gold, so that we can't print enough money to get ourselves out of this economic problem. We're currently experiencing a massive economic problem. We have really not resolved even from 2008, the last crisis. But we were able to get away from the big significant impacts of those because we did have the ability to print a massive amount of money through various resources, whether it was in recent times directly printing checks and mailing them out to people, or through actions of the Federal Reserve to infuse liquidity by the manipulations that the Fed does, for example, buying mortgages and mortgage-backed securities and treasury debt. Those things were not available. 1933. Yeah. We didn't have those options.
All right, let's slow down a little bit. So I got some questions here. Interesting. So Roosevelt came out and they said, we have to get out of the Great Depression and we need to print more dollars, right? So we need the gold. So you can't own gold anymore. So was this, in your opinion, some kind of just false flag made up story because something else, or was that really the reason, in your opinion?
Well, here's the problem. In 1933, we were still following the constitutional requirement that we couldn't print paper without gold reserves. So you couldn't print your way out of an economic problem simply by inflating the monetary system and expanding the supply of money. You had to have an equal amount of gold for every dollar you created. And the problem was is that in the 1920s, during the period they referred to as the Roaring Twenties, the Federal Reserve had expanded the money supply by such a dramatic amount, it was no longer able to keep that balance between gold reserves and money in circulation, and it knew that it had that problem. So the Fed itself began to take all the paper dollars that were gold-backed and redeem them at the Treasury window for the gold reserves that they were supplied back by. And as the depletion continued, the Treasury window. So let's say, for example, I'm the Federal Reserve and you're the United States Treasury. You're holding all the physical gold and I'm letting all of this paper that is supposed to be redeemed. I know that you don't have enough gold to meet the demand for all the paper I have. So I'm going to try to cash in as much of this paper as I can until you tell me you're out and you're done. And once I've done that, theoretically, we can't print any more money. So what the government did was they turned to the general public and said, look, Patrick needs more gold because Fred wants to print more money. And he can't do that unless Patrick has a gold supply.
But if Fred was printing the money, the Fed, and we were borrowing from them, right? They weren't just giving it to us. We were borrowing from them just like they do today. Why did Fred care if Patrick had the gold? So Fed was trying to stay in within the law, but you say during the Great Depression they didn't. The Treasury needed more money, so the Fed created more money without the amount of gold and loaned it to the Treasury.
Right, the Fed exceeded its gold reserves.
Okay.
And recognized that it had created that problem. So what they hoped to do was before the public caught on to the nature of the problem, which would have, let's say, thwarted the confidence in the general public, the value of the paper note.
Right.
Because again, we were still in a time frame, and I know it's hard to understand this now in 2021, but back in the 1930s, people would not have respected an unbacked paper note being issued by the government.
Wow.
They demanded that that note be backed by something physical.
Wow.
They wanted a gold and silver reserve against the money as the Constitution required. But when the Fed recognized that it had overprinted, it knew that if it showed up first at the Treasury window and gathered up all the gold, that it would be in the best position itself personally. Of course, it would leave the public somewhat stuck, now holding a bunch of paper notes that were not quite redeemable, because there simply wasn't a supply available for them to cash in their notes.
Are you saying the Fed could print? No, with the Treasury, the Treasury has always created the notes and they sell them to the Fed, right, for 3 cents or whatever. So are you saying that the Fed could actually have paper dollars, private bankers, and could bring them to the Treasury and get gold for them? I kind of lost you there.
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely.
What's up?
Anybody could at that point. Redeemable notes said on their face, this note redeemable for gold or silver coin.
That doesn't make sense.
Payable through the bearer on demand.
That doesn't make sense.
You could have walked into a Federal Reserve Bank in 1933 with a $20 gold certificate and literally demanded they hand you a $20 gold coin in exchange. So that was your legal right as an American citizen. That was your currency. It was a legal obligation and contract telling you right on the face of the bill that this is merely a storage. This is merely an obligation of the government, then they will supply you with this gold coin anytime you want it.
Wow.
And it is merely out of the convenience of holding the paper that you're not walking around with hundreds of dollars in gold coins in your pocket. Instead, you're carrying
paper. Because who wants to do that? So from 1776 to 1933, this is the way it happened. And the people, pretty much, I mean, there was ups and downs and all kinds of stuff that we won't get into, but that's fascinating.
So in 33, we hit a brick wall, and it became a big problem. So the need to create more money was larger than the problem, to the point where the Fed recognized that its only solution was to somehow replenish the vaults with more gold, since they knew they had overprinted. They didn't want the public showing up and then being told, sorry, we don't have enough gold to supply.
Right.
So the Fed showed up first, gathered up all the gold, and then basically forced the president to outlaw the public's ability to redeem these certificates for physical gold.
Let's go back a second. The Fed showed up first. They actually had paper dollars. I thought they only had assets in digits on their balance sheet. They actually had paper dollars.
No, they were accumulating the physical notes. They were gathering them up out of circulation.
Those rascals.
And then going to the redemption window and taking all the gold reserves out.
Wow. Wow.
Now, if you think about what would happen in that period, so if I showed up with a $20 gold certificate, guaranteed to give me a $20 gold coin, you now hand me that gold coin, you had to destroy that particular certificate. It had to be basically destroyed. because otherwise it could recirculate.
Oh, the bank did. Somebody else. You gave it to the bank and the bank would shred it. They would destroy it.
It had to be shredded and destroyed.
Interesting.
So what happens is you have a massive shrinking of the amount of paper money around in circulation.
Yes.
This was what the Depression was about. It was an absence of actual cash.
Actual cash.
There was literally no money to pay people. You didn't have the available cash to give somebody. You couldn't hand them the $20 bills because they weren't around.
You know, my mom told me that. She told me that early on. I never did, of course, get it because before I met you guys, you and Andy, she used to tell me that. She said, there just wasn't any money, Patrick. I don't know why. There just wasn't any money. I mean, nobody had any money. Isn't that interesting?
Exactly.
Wow.
And this is why, because all the money was being destroyed as quickly as possible so that it could be redeemed for the gold reserves. Hmm. Now, in the modern era, we don't face that problem because we can print without having any gold or silver backing.
Doesn't matter.
And then worry about the fact that we inflate its value by doing so later. But in 33, they didn't have that option. So now the public is stuck with two problems. All the gold is being depleted from the treasury vaults, and there's a lack of actual money circulating in the economy. And a depression, by definition, is really an absence of cash. And this was the fundamental problem. You couldn't pay people. You couldn't hand them money. You couldn't write them a check. They couldn't cash it in at a bank. Nobody had any cash available. So to resolve the problem, they decided that what they would do is issue a law that was passed by Roosevelt in 33. And basically, it did several things. First thing it did is it said, okay, we promise the public we will still maintain gold reserves and silver against our dollar. However, you can no longer ask for it physically. You merely have to now trust us.
Oh, they claimed they were going to have enough gold, Fred, for the dollars. They claimed.
Yes.
But you can't ask for it.
They claimed that they would keep that standard, but you couldn't have it anymore. So they stopped the redeemability clause after 1933. And from that point, they also stopped producing physical gold coins, which is when that last 1933 was minted.
This is interesting.
And then the mint was ordered to melt all of its gold coins that it had produced, but a couple of them apparently,
they have the
squeaked out.
They have the executive order here on this article of this coin being sold for 19.5.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it says, under executive order of the president issued April 5, 1933, all persons are required to deliver on or before May 1st, 1933, all gold coin. See, I thought coins were not part of this, but that's not true. Well, let's stop though. Let me read the thing first. All gold coin. Oh yeah, maybe not new. Okay. All gold coin, gold bullion, gold certificates now owned by them to the Federal Reserve Bank branch or agency or to any member bank of the Federal Reserve System. But see, they're not giving these to the Treasury, they're giving them to the Fed, which is the private. How'd they pull that one off?
Sure. Well, again, since the Fed was in control since 1913 of the monetary policies, they were beginning to wield their power.
Wow.
Again, prior to 1913, beginning of 1914, we didn't have a Federal Reserve Bank.
Right.
All of this would have been handled directly by the Treasury, and it would have been, instead of reading that you would redeem these at the Federal Reserve, it would have read that you would redeem these at the Treasury.
Gotcha.
But the Fed had taken over the control and issue of money.
So, but I was under the impression that numismatic coins were not part of this deal, but this says gold coin.
Well, again, if you continue to read, and as it got more specific, it did reference there was an exception.
Really?
For coins that had a value above merely their melt content.
Interesting. So this is in the fine print.
So, rare or valuable. Ah. Yes, they were exempt from this ruling.
I'll be.
So if you happen to have a rare gold coin from the Civil War period that had much more value than merely the metal content, those kinds of coins were excluded from the recall. Now, of course, this was a little vague, and this was all new. This was something never had been done before. So I don't think the public quite really understood it. I mean, look, we're still discussing it now in 2021. You can imagine what kind of confusion must have existed in 1933.
Right.
When all of a sudden your government is telling you, do you own gold? Guess what? You need to give it to us.
Bring it in.
And we're going to give you in exchange a bunch of these paper notes. And by the way, you can't redeem them for gold anymore. But don't worry. We're going to keep a gold reserve against them, just like we always did. Just don't ask for it. Just trust us that we'll maintain this reserve standard.
I wonder what was the mechanism the lawfulness of this executive order. They had to come up with something, right? Some kind of a...
It was the threat of jail sentence.
No, some kind of emergency, wouldn't they, Fred, to have to do an...
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The executive order was written under an emergency act by the president.
By the president.
Authorizing the action. They deemed the end of the Great Depression a national emergency and said, look...
That's all they got to do, right?
You know, we've been in this now for years, and we can resolve the problem. We have a solution, but this is what it's going to require. And look, you know, the public bought into it completely, hook, line, and sinker.
Did they?
They recognized that this was, an unusual circumstance, but they believed that the government plan would work. And I don't know, maybe there was an expectation that at some point we might revert back to the redeemability clause. I think that was an optimistic expectation.
Did they?
But had it, of course, in retrospect, it never occurred. And it lasted for, again, 45 some odd years till 71. You just couldn't own gold. It was just like, look, we can force the public to just use this unbacked paper if we can stop this whole gold standard problem. So let's just take that off the table and say, we'll back our money, but don't ask for it. And then we can continue then to create more money. So now the public turns its gold over to the Treasury. The Treasury has now a replenished vault full, which it now can create additional paper from.
He froze up. I think it's him. I think he's got a little issue with his interweb. It does that every now and then. Let me check mine. Fred Jaszewski's here. If you have a question, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Let me check my interweb, make sure it's not mine. No, we're banging out. Fred's got an issue with his internet. It does that from time to time. So this is good stuff. And we'll get into it, but so what happened was, my understanding, in between 1933 and 1971, other countries could bring their dollars in exchange for gold. So they did that for all these years, 1933 to 1971. And then that got out of control, especially when France was bringing boatloads of dollars in, and they wanted gold for it. And so then President Nixon did another executive order in 1971 and said, no more, you can't do it. So that's where we've been since 1971, is where now it's just Katie bar the door, and you can just print all you want at the Fed, and we borrow it from the Fed. And there's probably, I don't know, we'll ask Fred, but I think the latest estimate is about $35 to $40 trillion out there. I'd sure like to know exactly how many dollars were in circulation in 1933. There's probably not any real good numbers for that. It's U.S. coin capital. Now, everywhere you go, if you go on the interweb, thank you, Al Gore, for doing that for us, you'll see the word inflation. That's a big one. Because what's going on with this new socialist agenda of Green New Deal, income equality, all the COVID nonsense, and then they're going to probably want to forgive all of the student loans, being the social eye that they are. Oh, there's Fred. Fred, we're going to have to get you a little more bandwidth, man.
I don't know what happened.
Do you got pretty good speeds, you think, there?
I do. I have, the fastest available.
So you just blipped out. Yeah, it just blipped out.
And it happens.
It did that last month. Okay. So I was just kind of musing here while waiting. I know you'd come back. Do we have any idea, can you speculate, I'm real curious, the amount of dollars that were in circulation in 1933 when old Roosevelt pulled this off? Can we guess at all? I mean, wouldn't you love to know that number?
Interesting. I'd have to dig into that a little bit.
I wonder if Andy's got that in his book, The Real World of Money. I'll look. I don't know.
I don't think so, but it shouldn't be a hard statistic to come up with.
Really?
Yeah, off the top of my head, I don't want to guess.
Again, though, this executive order says you got to bring it to the Fed. Did somehow the Fed then give the gold back to the Treasury?
Well, effectively, yes. So in other words, the way the process worked is that, you know, Congress authorizes the issue of money. Then the Bureau of Engraving and Printing physically prints the money. It then sells that capital to the Federal Reserve for the cost of the paper and ink. It costs two or three cents to produce it.
Yeah.
And the Fed takes the money and loans it back. So, yeah, through a somewhat convoluted process of one hand over the other and going back and forth, the money would come into the Fed but eventually get back to the Treasury.
But the
whole point was they were trying to maintain that legal requirement that said you just can't print money if you don't have a gold reserve to match it. And we need to see that those gold reserves exist, because other foreign countries were holding massive amounts of U.S. dollars. And they were doing that under the idea that these are gold-backed notes.
Right.
They weren't going to simply hold on to those notes if they were not backed by gold or silver. So we had to maintain this for the world's reserves. And this was prior to World War II, where we force-fed the U.S. dollar on a lot of countries. Even before that, a lot of foreign nations were holding U.S. dollars as we were growing as a nation, becoming progressively stronger and stronger. And we became a viable economic environment throughout the world. And our currency, of course, was well respected. But again, it was respected with the idea that it is backed by gold. It wasn't simply, you know, foreign investors holding U.S. dollars because they thought we were great. They did it because they knew that there was gold backing. And even after the gold outlaw of ownership existed in America, it didn't exist in Europe.
They could still exchange, right?
If you were in Europe, you could exchange your paper U.S. notes for gold. You just couldn't do it in America.
Boy, they had to have a lot of gold, but we just don't know how many notes were out there. I mean, it's interesting. So I was telling the listeners, I think this is accurate. So during the time between 33 and 71, countries, France, anybody could bring their dollars in, and we would give them an ounce of gold. At that point, was it, Fred, about $15 an ounce or 12 or?
About $35, yeah.
35?
You know, went between $29 and $35 an ounce.
$35 an ounce, wow, okay.
Now, the European banks held a lot of American gold coins, which once this gold standard shift occurred, monstrously large amounts of U.S. gold coins were shipped over to Europe and stockpiled in European banks, and they were held there until, you know, mostly the 1980s and 90s when they started to come back. But the European banks held big supplies of U.S. gold coins. So, you know, if you were a French citizen and you walked into a bank in Paris with a U.S. paper $20 note gold-backed, they had American $20 gold coins to hand you over the counter.
Did they?
So you could redeem your paper notes for gold, which, again, sustained the demand. They just outlawed the private ownership here in the United States and kept that until 1971. By that point, it had become fairly obvious that this pretense was ridiculous, that, you know, the idea that, you know, the promise to hold gold reserves against what we were printing was so far removed from reality at that point that Richard Nixon just said, look, you know, there's no point in even pretending anymore. and it also became too expensive. Even by the 1960s, the problem had become apparent. We couldn't mint a silver dime because it cost 15 cents worth of silver to make a dime. So if you minted a silver dime that had 15 cents worth of silver, what would happen is everybody would melt the dime, keep the money, and the dime would never circulate. So it defeated its own purpose. So they had to pull the silver standard off of the dimes and quarters and half dollars.
In 1964. Now, hey, here's a good question for you. Interesting, from Jeff. It's been said that one of the reasons why President Kennedy was killed because he printed silver certificates out of the Treasury. Does Fred know how much he printed and were they pulled out of circulation?
What he printed were called U.S. notes. So they were similar to the silver certificates in that they subverted the whole idea of the Federal Reserve being a participant in the creation of money. So like President Lincoln had before him, Kennedy looked at the system and said, well, wait a minute, why do we have to borrow money directly from the Fed? I have authority as president to issue at least a certain quantity of notes. So it wasn't unlimited. There was a limit to the number that he could do. But he began to produce these, what they called red sealed $2, $5, $20 notes. And they said at the top, United States note, instead of the blue silver certificate or the green seal Federal Reserve notes. the idea was that the Treasury directly created those notes instead of subbing this job through the Federal Reserve.
Banks were not happy.
The Fed did not like
they were not happy. They were not
happy. Well, then, when Lincoln tried to do the same thing, you know, when Lincoln tried to get around the central banks of his day by issuing the first greenbacks, he had the Treasury print money. And again, there was a big pushback from the central bankers because that really threatened their position of authority in the creation of money.
Do we know how many that Kennedy did, Fred? Do we know?
You know, that
was
that
it 300 million? Was it 300 million?
It wasn't a huge amount. It wasn't a huge amount, but it was in an executive order. Again, that eludes me off the top of my head. But there was a limited number of those that were issued, and they're still floating around. You know, we see them from time to time. Collectors love them. You know, you could buy like a $2 red seal. That probably cost you maybe $10. Yeah. You could buy a $5 for maybe $15 or $20. And they're interesting because they, first of all, the color seal is different. And again, at the top, it says United States note instead of Federal Reserve note.
Yeah.
It just sort of says, well, wait a minute, there's something different. What is this about?
What is this?
That we did over here.
What is this about?
And there were some theories. And I, you know, again, everything has its weight, if you will, in terms of reality. How much of an impact this was, who knows? But the theory goes that as a response to John Kennedy's issue of United States notes, the Federal Reserve responded, and they responded violently.
Yeah.
So this is one of the theories of why he may have been assassinated, was because his efforts were to try to subvert. He was also one of the first presidents to instruct his Treasury Department to start playing a new game, which was, if the Federal Reserve was going to try to manipulate the value of money as president, he was stuck with this process of having to sub this job out. What he did is he instructed his Treasury Department to start buying foreign currencies.
He
said, we can stockpile other currencies, and we can do this as a method of counteracting the power of the Federal Reserve. We don't have to stockpile all of these Federal Reserve notes. What if we stockpiled the European countries' notes? So he began to instruct the Treasury Department to start accumulating foreign currency notes and store them in the Treasury's vaults as a method of sort of stabilizing the value of currencies around the world. It was an interesting, concept.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
And again, created a lot of pushback.
Yeah. So, I mean, certainly the bankers weren't happy. Of course, Andy talked about a lot of the other ideas why JFK may have been assassinated with Vietnam and the CIA, that he and his brother didn't like those boys. So there was a lot of people that didn't like JFK.
Sure.
They could have
gotten. They're turning their backs on, the organized crime guys who helped get Kennedy elected and the unions and all that work that had been done. So, there are an awful lot of theories. And, you would have figured at this point, this long since that event, we would know. We still don't know. But they release documents every few years now. I mean, we're getting to that point where, after everything had happened with Kennedy, they said, 50 years from now, we'll start releasing. Well, we're past that point. And every once in a while, there are these big dumps of data from a lot of the information that was around at that point. And we continue to learn a little bit more. I know it was about 2 years ago, there was a massive dump of John F. Kennedy-related documents that came out. And people were scouring through it. I mean, it was just a huge dump of data. And people were going through it for weeks and weeks and weeks, just trying to review to find little tidbits. And, for those people that were willing to do that kind of research, I'm sure there were some really interesting things to be found.
Yeah.
Now, some 6 years later.
Fred Dashefsky is here. It's the Real World of Money. His company is uscoincapital.com. So here's let's do this one first. So it feels like there's, I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, Freddie, but some kind of a monumental shift going on with the vision or the policy of the Fed, the Treasury, the people that are controlling the Biden administration with all the different social things in the Green New Deal and income equality and all this in infrastructure and the COVID thing, and they're probably going to, monetize all the student loans and all this social stuff. Is this a big shift going on with the idea of that doesn't matter even more so than it's never mattered, and we're just going to print and borrow until, I don't know, till the cows come home? Is this something big going on?
Yeah, what's interesting is the power of the Fed has grown dramatically the past decade or so, explosively, and they become so much more of a bigger player within the economy. You know, they're so much more of a driving force instead of just being a, you know, a rudder behind the boat and, you know, merely making a few adjustments here and there. They're now the engine. You know, they're running the whole thing. You know, a good statistic came out from, remember Judy Shelton? She was supposed to be a part of the Federal Reserve Bank. She was hopefully was going to become one of the governors. And she had been a kind of an opponent, if you will, of the gold standard years ago. And they had picked up on that. And there was this whole hubbub. Anyway, she had an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal. She pointed out that the bank reserves from the Fed, which were less than $2 billion in 2008, grew to $3.8 trillion by the end of last year. So the Fed's position in the economy has exploded. The amount of control that the Fed has over the economic environment now is much greater than ever before. They are the force. They are the engine now behind the entire market. All the stimulus that has come out from the Fed, the explosion of the Fed's balance sheet. You know, we talked on your show, I think it was less than 2 years ago, when a lot of the COVID stuff had first started, we had about a $4 trillion balance sheet on the Federal Reserve.
And I'm looking
books.
Right now for June 3rd.
And I had estimated, and I had said it, at, you know, if this goes the way I think it will, by the time this is done, we're going to have $9 or $10 trillion on a Fed balance sheet, which sounded absurd when it was $4 trillion. And here we are now. They're now estimating by next year, $9 trillion is going to be on the Federal Reserve balance sheet.
Seven.
And they're still buying $120 billion a month in both treasuries and mortgage backs.
$7,895 billion this morning. Wow, almost $8 trillion. Now tell folks why that matters and where that comes from. Those $8 trillion. How did they accumulate? They're just pieces of paper, right? That they created dollars for on a computer to exchange. Is that right?
Well, that's correct, but what they're doing is significant. So, you know, they're buying several things. It started with quantitative easing, where they began to buy all of the long-term treasury debt because that paid the highest yield. So in order to get the best interest rates, you had to buy the longest term debt. So the government offers debt in the form of 1 year, 5 year, 10 year, 20 and 30 year notes and bills and bonds. The longer term, the higher the interest, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. You're locked in for a longer term, you get a better yield. What the Fed did is, in order to keep interest rates low, they began to be the heavy buyer of all the long-term debt. They accumulated the stuff that paid the best interest rates, leaving everybody else only be able to get minimal interest rate payments on their debt. So they tried to force interest rates down by doing that. Simultaneously, they were out purchasing directly from the U.S. Treasury about $120 billion every month in bonds directly from the U.S. This provided liquidity. And this is what the country needed coming out of an economic crisis that had stalled the economy. Mm-hmm. So the Fed's policy has basically been, okay, the economy is slowing down. Whatever the reason is that that happened, regardless of that, the way to move it forward is to make sure that money is available and cheap money is available and that there's plenty of liquidity. How do we inject liquidity? Well, we come into the Treasury Department, we hand them a check and keep buying Treasury securities from the Treasury directly. Treasury then can allocate that capital. The Fed also utilizes a very interesting other tool, which is it offers a good value to banks to hold excess reserves on their balance sheets and pays them a good interest rate. That kind of creates an environment where the banks will store large amounts of capital and reserve capital. And by manipulating these accounts, by making it either better or worse for the banks, the Fed can also control the flow of money. If they can encourage the banks to loan the money out, more money will circulate through the economy. If they can encourage the banks to store more reserves, they can control the flow of capital. And the Fed has stepped in and used all of these various processes, not just like a little bit here and there like they used to periodically throughout the economy and the environments. Now it has become the driving force of the economy.
Everything.
They are basically controlling everything with these mechanisms. And that's really problematic because it's like a shot of last resort. It's the Hail Mary pass. It's
really?
Just you hope you throw that football downfield and somebody catches it because you don't have any other options. You're down to your last, you know, available option. Your magic bag of tricks has been turned over and dumped out and everything has fallen and the dust is gone. And what do we have left to do here?
Fascinating.
So the Fed is now so much a part of the economy that as opposed to just merely being an underlying, you know, resource that helped you know, sort of stabilize, it has become the driver of the economy. Without the Federal Reserve stimulus, without all that capital reserve pushed out, without them forcing banks to hold reserves, without their purchases of mortgage backs, think about what's happening to the real estate market.
Yeah.
As overvalued as it has become,
they're buying,
the Fed is still buying
more. They're buying 40, I read this morning, Freddie, they're buying $40 billion a month of mortgage-backed securities.
Yes.
So tell folks how that works. Patrick gets a mortgage, and 1,000 other people get the mortgage. They slice and dice it, right? And they put them in tranches, and they create a mortgage-backed security for $1 billion, whatever it is. They have A's and B's and C's, and they put them all together. Depending on our credit rating, they're priced a certain thing. So the banks then package this MBS into a debt instrument. It's a separate thing, right? They take the mortgages, make a debt instrument.
Leveraged pretty extensively, too.
Yeah, and they're leveraged, so it might not be as quite as worth as what they sell it for. And then the Fed...
Oh, no, not even close.
They're not even close. So then the Fed can create dollars on their little computer and then buy it from Wells Fargo, a mortgage-backed security, right? So then that drives...
Exactly. So now imagine if you're Wells Fargo now, and I come to you and I say, I want to take out a loan for a new house.
Right.
Well, there are two options. Number one is I take the loan directly from you. You carry that note for the whole period of time I have that mortgage. I make my payments, you're happy. I don't make payments, you lose. But what if instead, when I come to you and say, I want to buy this house and take out that mortgage, you can write me that mortgage agreement, but you don't have to wait for me to make a payment. You can immediately sell that mortgage to the Federal Reserve and get paid 100%. Whether or not I ever make a single payment no longer becomes a variable for you. Your incentive to write mortgages increases dramatically because your risk has been reduced to zero.
And that's why prices are rising, home prices, right? Because they're making it very low interest rates and
so
making
easy.
It very easy to buy. We're not back to the whole ninja no income, no job mortgage loans, are we?
Nope, but we're doing just about the same thing in virtue of having the Federal Reserve step in and make all
same
these
thing.
Purchases at this extent for so long. They're basically doing the same thing. They're creating a bubble. They're creating an artificially overvalued market because they're making the ease of liquidity too easy. And by lowering mortgage rates and the interest that we have to pay as consumers and offering the banks separately the ability to dump these mortgages immediately and get paid, you've created a monstrous availability of reserve capital to purchase homes that has afforded the ability for speculators to come into the market and say, well, I don't know what's going to happen with the economy. Maybe I'm worried the stock market is overvalued. Normally, if this was a regular economy, I would just park money in a treasury security for a while until I figure out what to do because it pays me some sort of reasonable interest. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, whenever I figure out what to actually do with my capital, I'll sell that security that I purchased and move on. Well, what if that security interest that you're buying from the government doesn't pay you a yield that even covers the current rate of inflation? So if you were to do that, park your money in that treasury security, the problem is you'd technically be losing money. Not technically.
Yeah, 10 years are what, a point
money.
And a half. 1.5% interest if you loan the government money for 10 years, 1.5%.
Right, and the inflation rate is 3%.
Oh, at
so
least.
You're losing 1.5%.
You're being kind.
And again, that
you're being very
I'm
kind.
Being kind. I'm even like, accepting the government statistical nonsense.
Yeah, well, good luck with that.
Consumer price index and other fairy tales, right? So, you know, you've created an environment here where I can't park my money in a treasury. That doesn't make any sense. So what am I going to do? Well, what if I could borrow money for next to zero? And I have a guaranteed loan coming from my bank because the bank doesn't care. They'll give me the mortgage immediately because they know they could sell that mortgage directly out to the Fed. And they don't have any risk. So what happens? A lot of people end up buying real estate by default.
That's what's going on
right now. So
what
happens to the price of real estate?
Yeah.
It up, starts going higher and higher. Now, eventually, it gets to a point where it is way overvalued. But when does that end? You know, does it end when the speculators stop buying? Does it end when the Fed stops accumulating mortgage-backed securities, when the Fed begins to become less accommodative? They've been discussing this with Chairman Powell for a year now, and he keeps saying, as far as the eye can see, we will continue to be an accommodative Fed. You know,
we'll just print as much as we need because
buying these mortgage securities. So, and secondarily, we're still buying all these treasuries.
So people looking at selling or buying a home, they're not real sure what's going on because of what, for the reasons you just said. We just don't know.
Sure.
Yeah. And it's not, and then what's a challenge also with these homes prices going up, rents are going up.
Well, yeah, rents are going up.
So it hurts the smaller people too, right?
Simultaneously.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. Because not only are rents going up, but wage pressures are coming into the economy now as well, because price increases are happening across the board in almost everything. The consumer is beginning to feel the impact of the printing of capital the past few years. It is beginning to actually have the effect you would expect it to. Mm. You know, until recently, lumber prices were up 300%
from
a year
ago. Did you see that?
Wow. It was stunning. And again, it's a result of several things. This massive amount of printing of paper, plus the supply chain problem, which we haven't even talked about.
I know.
You could probably spend an hour just on that.
Just,
but there is a worldwide supply chain problem.
Right
and,
now.
And it was due to the fact we pushed this just-in-time ordering system through the economies of the world in the past decade, which was supposed to streamline, you know, the production from the manufacturing plant to the moment that that was finished, it would go on a truck, and that truck would just make it to the port just before the big ship would take off, and then would land at the next port of where it was going, and then you'd have people that would unload those things, and they would be put on the various trucks, shipped over to the product, end result, everybody gets their products in, you know, in the fastest time frame. But what they didn't plan on is interruptions in this tight, just-in-time ordering system.
Boy, and they
if there's
out,
any interruption in that chain, the whole thing falls apart. And the next thing you know, things back up by weeks and months. Then we had the Suez Canal problem where we blocked up the entire Suez Canal for a couple of weeks. You have massive supply chain issues going around the world. There aren't enough people because we had the COVID crisis to actually physically unload cargo ships when they hit port. So cargo ships were sitting laden with product for weeks at a time. They couldn't unload them.
Oh, is it people
thing? So stuff is going
bad. Oh, because of the whole COVID restrictions and masking and social and whatever. But now we have billions of jobs and nobody wants to go to work too. I mean, that's a whole other thing too. You know.
And we still have the backlog. And it's going to take, I'm telling you, it'll take 6 months at least for this backlog to unwind. We'll probably be feeling this through the end of the year. Come Christmas time, you know, there will be things that will not be available. I mean, if you look at the normal shipping time that for anything, you try to buy furniture and get it shipped, you know, instead of 7 to 10 days, they're talking 3-4 months at a time now. And that sometimes is early.
So some people, I don't understand, though, most of this stuff is from California, right? I'm sorry, China. I saw this morning 60% of the apple juice it comes from China. 60% of the apple juice. I don't know. Right now, we used to produce about 40% of the chips, you know, the computer chips. Now we do 12%. They're way behind on those, and that's everything from cars to tractors to whatever, washing machines, right? All that stuff. I have a fellow that's still wanting to put, we want to put in a little bit small air conditioner, a special one for the studio, the outside, a special one. And we have no idea when it's going to be here. And this was 2 months ago. It's just, they're just out of stock. You know, it's a China thing.
And there are going to be an awful lot of very strange products because it's unrelated to the product. It has nothing to do with what it is. It just has to do with where it's coming from. So in the case of the microchip, who would have thought that the automobile industry would be struggling to produce cars because it couldn't get a computer chip? That was just something nobody would have thought
of. Not a clutch.
5 years ago.
A computer
chip. That would have been the problem. You know, a computer chip. I can't build my car because it has 100 computer chips in it, and I can't even get them delivered. So I can't produce cars.
I'm still kind of curious. So I understand, I get where there was a while where you couldn't unload cargo ships because of the whole COVID thing, but that's got to be over now and coming into California. I mean, why is it all backed up now still? I don't understand that.
Again, it was backing up for month after month after month after month, and now we're beginning to feel the impact of it, and it's going to take months for it to get caught up.
Wow.
It's just not easy to, you know, solidify that smooth chain. You know, again, when everything works just in time, that's the key. It all has to work just in time. But if you interrupt that at any point, you're going to end up with a serious backlog, and it's going to take quite a while for it to unwind itself. I'm speculating this won't be resolved till at least the first part of next year.
Is that right?
I think we're going to be experiencing shortages of products right through the end of the year. I think it's going to hurt the holiday season shopping problems. It's going to exacerbate a lot of issues for delivery of all sorts of products. And it's going to be random. It's going to be really haphazard. It's going to be a plastic screw, you know, a microchip, a piece of furniture, a small air conditioner. It's going to be odds and ends that just happen to have been, you know, caught in the daisy chain.
Yeah.
Part of the reason they were having a problem with pushing Brexit, for example, was they were going to change a border line between two countries that instead of being like two states in the U.S., where I drive from New York to New Jersey, I don't go through a border. I just simply cross a state line. Now, if we create that as a national border, well, now all of a sudden you have to have a stopping point and you have to have inspections and things like that. Well, that slows down the whole process to the point where that daisy chain would have backed up things in Europe for 2 to 3 months. So instead of something going from Ireland to France and taking 3 days, now it's going to take 3 weeks. And that's all it took, was just you set up a border between two countries. That was enough to block the chain of flow. So we're doing this on a worldwide basis now. One of my customers is in the transportation business, and he was telling me that, you know, when you're shipping things, let's say from California to Shanghai or from New York to Shanghai, and you want to, you know, load up a cargo ship, well, you've got how many hundreds of containers will fit on a cargo ship? So you load up the cargo ship with hundreds of containers, you send that thing off to China, and there it goes. Or it comes from China laden with hundreds and hundreds of cargo ships and hundreds of containers. Well, now if you can't do that, but you still need to move product, you know, you're reduced to having to put it on an airplane. But the problem is an airplane can only hold one. It can't hold 100.
Yeah, one.
It can hold one. And how many flights from JFK to Shanghai are there going to be in a single day? There aren't going to be 100 of them. So how do you move 100 of these crates from New York to Shanghai or Shanghai to New York?
How do we get so dependent on China? This has been an ongoing thing for years, right? This whole China thing and what Trump talked about. He wanted to kind of squash it a little bit. But, man, we're really in with these guys.
With the labor costs of manufacturing, right? As soon as it became cheaper to build a plant in China or in Indonesia or Vietnam and produce product there instead of what you had to pay to do that in America, it was far cheaper for companies to set up manufacturing plants in other places around the world. They could save a ton of money every year, and then all they had to do was ship it, which at the time didn't appear to be a problem.
Now
turned out to be another issue that nobody thought would
huge,
be an issue.
Huge problem. Would you how do you solve something like that? Were you in favor then of what Trump was trying to do with the tariffs to balance this stuff out? Was that something you thought was smart?
Well, I thought that was smart because at one point, one of the issues that he was trying to address was why was there such a lopsided, you know, system? Why was it so heavily weighted this way?
The trade imbalance.
That, you know, our trade gaps were huge. So our trade deficits were massive because as we try to export products, China would charge tariffs to the import of American products into China, but we weren't charging the same kind of taxes for products coming to us from China. So between the fact that it was cheaper to manufacture in China and there were less tariffs to come in, it was much more beneficial and heavily weighted us to end up buying much more of the stuff that we accumulate than to produce it here at home, including our food. And that became a big problem. So that just perpetuated itself and it's become so lopsided that, like you said, you look at the percentages of things that we get from foreign countries, it's stunning. If we couldn't get delivery of products from foreign countries, if that all ended, we'd have a serious problem in America. Our shelves would be empty.
Well, they could cut us off tomorrow, man. Couldn't they? I mean, if they want. Of course, they have to sell their stuff, though, too. They've got to sell their stuff, too, right? They got to feed a billion people. So they're not going to cut us off. I mean, where are they going to get the money, you know, or whatever? I saw an article this morning, a short one, where there's actually, believe it or not, they're catching salmon in the United States. They send it to China to process them, and then they send it back here, you know, processed, and then we sell it here. Sam's Club or something, whatever. Crazy.
Yeah.
Okay. So when some of this, well, I got a couple more emails, but so I think it's a fair thing to say that we're going to see prices rising pretty much everywhere, right? continue.
Absolutely. For several different reasons.
Okay.
You know, you've got a combination of things now that are all lining up to create an inflationary problem we have not seen before in America. We have a massive amount of money being printed. And I mean massive. I mean, when we talk about trillions and trillions of dollars, you can't ignore the size of those numbers. They are incredibly large. So much so that, you know, government deficits now are exceeding the entire output of the country's production. We've never been in that kind of situation before. These were red line things, problems that they said, don't ever let us get to that point. You know, this was the real big problem. We'll never get to the point where, you know, the amount of deficit spending exceeds the GDP. If we do that, we're going to look like Greece. And they had riots in Greece within a year of when their country got to that point where its deficits exceeded its GDP. Fortunately for the United States, we're able to get away with this because the Fed keeps dropping interest rates at the same time that we're experiencing all these problems. So the inflationary pressures that should be created from all this have been pushed back. But between the amount of paper that we're printing, the amount that the government is deficit spending, the amount of debt we currently have, the interest payments that we're making on the debt, and now supply chain problems that are creating product increasing prices and labor pressures at the same, all at the same time now that are forcing labor. Look, the McDonald's around the corner from me has a 12-foot sign in front of the building that says, we're paying $12 an hour if you just come flip burgers. Please come in and apply for a job.
Is that right? My goodness.
Yeah. They cannot get labor. So
I know I have a neighbor with a restaurant, Fred. He can't get people to wait tables because they're making more money. Now Governor Abbott here, God love him, is going to end that, I think, in 2 weeks. They're going to end that $300 extra a week. And so I guess some more people. And I guess about 20 different states, all red states, are ending the $300 a week deal. But boy, people are like that, though. I mean, this idea of socialism, when you give people stuff, it's just human nature, right? They're going to stay home. They're going to stay home.
It is. Somebody said to me a couple weeks ago, and I thought this was brilliant, instead of having just issued checks to people to stay home, what they should have done is said, if you go get a job, we'll supplement your income by that same $300.
I like it. Yeah.
Right? So now the incentive is for you to get work. If you show me that you've gotten a job, it doesn't matter what it pays, we will guarantee an extra $300 a week in your payments. This way, you get that same stimulus effect, but you also drive people back to work.
That's good.
And you help the employment process. You help everybody who's looking for employers to suddenly get people to come to work.
I like it.
Because they're thinking, oh, this is great. I go get a job. Not only do I get paid, I get an extra $300 for having gotten a job. That's the way they should have done this. That would have been the right motivation. Instead of like what you said, what's the motivation for a guy sitting at home getting a paycheck from the government that's greater than the amount he can earn if he goes and gets a job?
Plus, he's getting his regular unemployment too, which has been extended. So they're really making some money. They're not going back. And wow.
And let me tell you, all of this together is so massively inflationary that there's no way around this anymore. The inflation numbers are going to be staggering. And I think the Fed is going to get caught flat-footed because they don't have a mechanism to deal with inflation at this level with this many different parts of the economy causing the inflation. The traditional raising interest rates to slow down inflation is not going to be an effective tool because it's not the only variable anymore. It's not the cost of borrowing money that's creating the inflation. There are a lot of other things happening simultaneously, and the Fed is not going to be in a position where it has the tools to address this. And what I'm afraid is going to happen is, I'm looking historically again. I've been researching this stuff back to the beginning of the 19th and 20th centuries. Every time the Fed has made decisions that have affected the economy that have gone bad, it's always because they've reacted too late or too slowly or overreacted.
Hmm.
And I have a feeling what's going to happen now is instead of just simply tapping on the brake pedal, they're going to slam on the brakes. They're going to try to do something because they have their hands forced. And what they do is going to create a kind of a real hiccup in the economy. And I think we're going to experience a lot of volatility because of the Fed's actions. They've put themselves in a very dangerous corner by having taken control of the economy in so many different ways. We're now reliant on the Fed much more than we ever have before. I mean, look at the size of the impact of the Fed now in the overall economy compared to even from 2008. I mean, again, as Judy Shelton pointed out, you're talking about a $2 billion excess reserve depository account in the Fed in 2008 that is now at $3.8 trillion.
Now, tell us again what that means, kind of the reserves. So in other words, the banks, say I'm Wells Fargo, the Fed will pay me money to put my dollars on their balance sheet?
Yeah, to leave it in their account, you know, to hold it in reserve.
At the Fed.
And the Fed will pay the interest on those accounts slightly higher than they can get on the open market. So slightly higher than the Fed funds rate.
And why do they do that? What's the goal?
Well, again, the incentive is to try to drive the capital so that they can keep the cost of borrowing money down and to keep the flow of money within control. So, again, they do this periodically where, you know, they would occasionally move the rate that the Fed will pay on the overnight window, the discount rate, and what the Fed pays for excess reserves. And they do this to manipulate the flow of the economy. The problem is the Fed is stepping in now at too much of a level to the economic environment to, I don't even think they're big enough to control this. You know, I look at, for example, let's say that they're right and the estimates that they're going to have $9 trillion on the balance sheet by the end of the next year. We're still carrying the $4 trillion from 2008 that the Fed had been trying to unwind since 2008, before COVID.
Yes.
And was only able to unwind about a half a trillion of that before that had so much of an effect on the economy, it began to backwash. They had to slow down the way that they were trying to unwind their reserves. So if it was 2008 when we had $4 trillion, we haven't reduced that by any significant amount. Now we're going to have $9 trillion by the end of next year. At what year will they finally be able to unwind any of this? It's going to take them at least 10 years before they can
really address. By unwinding, so people know, Fred, you're talking about they've got to sell this stuff because it's paper and there's counterparties and they got to get it off their balance sheet. Otherwise, people lose confidence in the dollar, right?
Exactly. There's so much that the Fed can hold in terms of debt. You know, it's like if you had a multiple number of kids in your family and they were all coming to you to say, hey, Dad, you know, can I borrow money? And yeah, you keep loaning it to them. But, you know, at some point you're holding all of this debt and now you have to go borrow money. You know, well, who's going to loan you money when they look at your balance sheet and say, well, wait a minute, you're already carrying, you know, four kids and all their debt. And, you know, you just don't have enough. Now, again, my concern is somewhat on a broad nature, but I think the Fed has overstepped. I think they've overdone their impact into the economy. It was by default because there were simply no other options. The other option would have been to address the reality. And that's what they're trying to avoid, is having to face the reality of, hey, we printed trillions of unbacked dollars. We've created a massive amount of inflation. The money supply in the last 12 months has grown by 30%, the M2, 30%.
And they've stopped counting, right? We can't even see the charts anymore. We don't even see the charts anymore.
Yeah. So how do you have a 30% monetary expansion with a GDP? And let's be nice and say the GDP is what, 6%? I think that's a pretty fair. You know, the government will say it's 4 and change. Probably will end up being close to 6 by year end. I think there will be great economic growth this year. But you can't absorb a 30% increase in the money supply with only a 6% expansion in the GDP. That still leaves 24% unaccounted for. That's all inflationary. Hmm. And on top of the supply chain problem, the government deficit spending, and the fact that the government is planning to also allocate another $6 trillion on top of everything else at this point for all new programs with money we don't have. You know, if prices don't go up, I don't know anything.
You're probably talking about a bonded debt, maybe of $35 trillion at least, right? We're at 30 now, about 30. 35 trillion.
31 now.
Yeah, 35 trillion.
You know, when it hit 10 trillion about a decade ago, people freaked out.
I know, it's like, I remember.
Because we had to add another digit.
I remember.
You know, on the debt, they talked about it on the debt clock, they actually had to add another slot because they had to put that one, you know.
So
they didn't have room for it.
The interest at Treasury, we the people, remember folks, when we say Treasury, we're talking about we the people. Treasury, we are the Treasury. We're on the hook for this stuff, not Janet Yellen, but Fred and Patrick and you are on the hook for this stuff as taxpayers. So interest on the 30 trillion is probably what? I don't know. How much is it? Is it about $500 billion a year or something like that? Probably more, right? Even
yeah,
at three.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Wait, how did they get away? 3%, that'd be $900
billion. Yeah, I think the interest payments on the debt are approaching $1 trillion a year.
Are they?
Yeah, I think it's pretty close.
It must be, yeah. Even at 3%, that'd be $900 billion,
right? And, you know, the problem is that the interest on the debt is the second largest item in the federal government's budget now. So amongst everything else the federal government does, think about everything that the federal government does.
Interest.
Department of Defense. Interest on the debt is the second largest budget item.
What's the first?
And that, you know, that's a problem. That's an economic disaster waiting to happen.
What's the first?
Well, the first is Department of Defense.
Oh, about eight.
That's the first line.
Seven, eight. Oh, is it higher than?
That includes everything.
Wow.
It's much higher than.
And then they have all the shortfall of Social Security and Medicare, which I think is about 3 to 4 to 5, in that range, right?
And growing.
So that's why you can see why they're $2 trillion in the red just on each fiscal year now, right? You can see it. I mean, the numbers are pretty plain.
Yes. And, you know, what the Fed is doing is, again, becoming so much more of a bigger participant in the overall state of the economy that our reliance on them is far greater than it should be. You know, I've had a fundamental problem with the idea of the Federal Reserve from day one.
Sure.
And I've always argued we never needed a private central bank. A central bank, we could argue whether or not that works within an economy. That's fine. But a central bank owned by the public is one thing. A central bank owned by private bankers is another thing. So the fact that we never needed a private banking institution to own a central bank for our country, I think it's pretty well established. But when they become such a heavy manipulator of the economy, and they now control the game.
Like I said, they have moved
from merely being the rudder behind the boat. They are now the engine. They are the driving force of the economy. Without them, this boat does not move. And that is really fundamentally problematic, that we are so reliant on actions of the Federal Reserve that our entire economy is based on what they do. And now every move they make is going to have an impact. And the moves that they make are going to be more dramatic because the size of everything has exploded to the point where minor reserve amounts, 4 or 5% of the overall economic environment, is now 15 or 20%, or portions of what used to be a little bit of the part of the market economy are now vastly involved. Mortgage-backed securities now account for so much, and the purchases of those account for so much of the liquidity that is pushing the real estate market. And again, consider the stock market also as its own problem, because while the Fed did create an environment where it offered corporations incredibly cheap money to give them access to help move the economy forward, these corporations chose, instead of building new infrastructure and building new buildings and manufacturing plants, they decided they would buy their own stock instead.
And drive up their stock price.
So they took all that cheap money and said, hey, what if I drive up my own stock price by more than the cost of the interest on these loans I get from the government? So the government will give me money at 0.5% and I can drive my stock price 2%. Well, that's a lot of money when you're talking billions upon billions and billions of dollars. So we have a market of stocks where prices are driven by the fact that the corporations are given cheap money. And again, speculators have nowhere to go. You know, nobody knows what to do with large amounts of capital reserves because there's no interest payments on anything standard. So what do? You speculate. It's part of what's driving the cryptocurrencies too. The reason that there's so much speculation is people are just looking for anything. I mean, this is how ridiculous it's become. You know, people will buy Dogecoin, something completely made up, simply because
it's going
looking for an option to do anything other than the interest payments the banks will pay.
I've got an idea.
Something smart.
They could buy gold and silver coins. How about that?
There you go.
How about that?
Well, this is why gold isn't 300 an ounce anymore, and it's not 500 an ounce anymore, and it's not even 1,000 an ounce anymore. It's like 1,900 an ounce for gold now. And silver, you know, remember when we first started talking, silver was like $4 an ounce.
Yeah.
You know, today you're looking at $28 an ounce for silver, and this has to be a net result of all this printing of capital. So I think for those people that are storing money for the future, you need to store it in a form it won't erode as all of this economic nonsense continues. And the stability of gold and silver coins have been well proven and established since, again, they stopped making these gold coins in 1933. They stopped producing the silver coins in 1964. No matter what else happens, They cannot expand that supply. They can't leverage it.
These are all dated and certified in little plastic packages. You just can't make any more. And that's why this coin sold for.
That's it.
That's why this card sold for almost $20 million a couple days ago.
It's
the only one.
Yeah, exactly. One of one, and you have a dollar that isn't worth anywhere it was 10 years ago. So those two things combined, so you're looking at a reasonable opportunity. Now, you know, we had at one point said there would be a $10 million coin. You know, everybody laughed at that because when I first started in the business, there wasn't even a $1 million coin yet. Now we have 250 coins that have cracked the $1 million bracket, and we now set a world record for a single coin at almost 20 million. Again, these were unheard of numbers. Even a decade ago, people would have been, 20 million for a single coin, I don't know. You know, when the $1,794 sold for almost 10 million, it was a shock. And now this coin sells for 19 plus.
Let me show you Fred's company here. He gives you a little slide. And it's, I think I can still have you on the air while people look at this. I can't hear you. That's okay. But here's his phone number if you'd like to get your talk to Fred or Donna. 800-878-2646, U.S. Coin Capital, U.S. Coin Capital. Now, Fred, before we go, many of the coins that you sell are these $20 St. Gaudens that were available and happening during the Roaring Twenties. Is that right? That's what you sell a lot of those. Those are like your meat and potatoes kind of coins, right?
They are. They're the basic standard. The nice thing about them is you could buy one or 100 at a time, and you can sell one or 100 at a time. They're very easy to deal with in quantity. They're well-respected throughout both the United States and around the world. They're very easy to deal with and a great way for people to accumulate a quantity of value that will sustain itself. You know, keep in mind, in 1933, when they ended the production, you know, $20 was the equivalent of an ounce of gold and had the buying power to feed a family of four for a month. And today, you know, even a circulated $20 gold coin would bring a couple $1,000. You know, you could clearly still feed a family of four for a month with the kind of purchasing power that that coin has, if not more. When I remember, a silver quarter, 64, when they ended, that was about what a gallon of gas cost.
Yeah.
You know, it was about 25 cents. And today that silver quarter is worth about $7. So it'll buy almost 3 gallons of gas. So in other words, the buying power of these things holds up well over time. It's a great storage of value and a better place for people's savings than in any kind of paper money. You know, again, normally people would say, well, I can invest in the stock market and it is going up. The question is the value sustainable at these levels? Is the value in real estate sustainable at these levels? If we have a significant correction in either market, are people going to be, again, caught by surprise like they were in 2008? Or are they going to be aware enough to recognize this? All I can say is that historically, the single best thing for investors every single time has been diversification. It's just been don't be too heavily weighted in anything. In the 80s, it was mutual funds because they had tax benefits. And people thought mutual funds were the safest thing because stocks never went down. Well, that was great till 1987 when the market crashed. And then everybody lost their shirts in the mutual fund markets. Yeah. And then we went through the periods of the 90s where everything began to expand again. And then the relying theory was, okay, well, you buy real estate because real estate never goes down. And that started the expansion of speculative real estate buying. When people start borrowing money to buy an investment, it's problematic. And people are borrowing money now to invest in real estate. Corporations are borrowing money to buy stock. This is not sustainable. And there will be market corrections that are going to create volatility that will eventually come back, but it could take a decade. And a lot of people who are getting to retirement age, they just honestly don't have 10
have
years
the
to wait if the market
comes. Yeah, boy, it's a challenge. So
buy gold and silver coins and put them away physically. Own this physical asset because it's something you can touch. If I ask you to show me your Ether or your Bitcoin, what do you do? You can't show me something.
There's nothing there to show me. Boy, do you see?
Well, you know, if I ask you to show me your $20 gold coin, well, you know, you could pick the physical thing up and hand it to me. Here it is. It's a physical, tangible asset. a portion of people's wealth needs to be in that form. Absolutely essential.
And it's just been your experience, and Andy talked about it, and we get that question all the time. Regardless of the monetary situation, financial situation, in all the years you've been, you can always sell coins, right? You can always sell them. There's always buyers.
Of course.
Always buyers.
Absolutely.
Always buyers. So if you need to get liquid with these silly dollars, you can sell them.
Well, think about it. People just paid, somebody just paid $19.5 million for a single coin, right? You know, apparently there's not a problem in finding demand even for the most valuable kinds of coins. So, yeah, liquidity is always out there. You know, liquidity is always a function of price. And in any given market, there are better times to be a seller. Honestly, for people that are in real estate, they should be thinking about selling real estate now, not buying. But
might as well. Could be the time.
I do understand what's happening.
Yeah. Could be
yeah,
top.
I mean, again, a lack of options. You know, I talk to people every day that are sitting on piles of cash. They just don't know what to do. They're watching the money itself erode. They don't want to put it in the bank because it doesn't yield anything. They don't want to buy treasuries because it doesn't yield anything. And then they're locked up for these time frames. So they speculate. And, you know, again, that creates very bubblicious markets.
Bubblish. What does Fred think about, from Ellen, these shiny new quarters that we have seen over the past 3 to 4 years or so? We haven't shiny new quarters? They're not silver.
No, they're not silver. So, you know, the Treasury continues to come out with, you know, cute little new products.
I see.
But again, none of them have any actual value per se. Yeah, there are occasionally a few, you know, interesting things they've come out with that were scores. But basically, most of the stuff being produced now won't really carry much value going forward because, first of all, the volume of these things that they make are massive. And, of course, as you pointed out, there's no precious metal. Now, any of the specialty coins that come out that actually are made of silver, yeah, I mean, those things might carry some value. But what happens with new things is that you're speculating on whether or not there'll be a demand for them in the future. Otherwise, what will happen is they fall down to melt value. And that's happened numerous times with a lot of the new products. So I don't really see them as a viable alternative. It's a lot easier to buy a pre-64 quarter for $7 than speculate on some new silver coin coming out of the mint.
If folks are interested in pre-64 quarters, dimes, and halves, and silver dollars, you have stock of those at U.S. Coin Capital?
I do.
Huh.
I do.
That's a fun way.
We are selling bags and bags and bags of them every week. I mean, just
really?
A lot of quantity. These are being sold. Yeah, tons.
Wow. And people just stock a bag. What's a bag? How much is a bag weigh? How much is a bag weigh?
Well, a bag, by definition, we have to just qualify what we're talking about. So when they say a bag, the actual term within the industry refers to a $1,000 face value bag.
Okay.
That would be 10,000 dimes.
10,000?
So that's a full bag.
Dimes. Wow.
Yeah. 4,000 quarters or 2,000 half dollars. So it has to add up to 1,000 in face value.
I see.
If you weighed that, you know, just the bulk weight, it's about 52 pounds.
Whoa.
And we're talking about $26,000 to $28,000 for a bag.
Really? And the idea would be to have this as thinking 5 years from now, that $28,000 is going to be worth more because silver is going to move, will go up because of all the reasons we talk about, rather than having $28,000 in the bank and you could be losing money because of inflation. Is that the idea of owning P64s?
You absolutely are losing money to inflation. Look, we sold these same bags for $4,000 just a decade ago.
Wow, really?
Full bags of silver were $4,000.
Yeah. Same bags? And they're $28,000 today?
Yep.
Yow. But silver hasn't gone up that much. It's just the supply.
Well, it has, though.
It has.
It's been creeping up slowly. And, you know, it's you don't notice it, but... You know, again, it was $8, $10 an ounce and $11 and $12 and $15, and now it's $28. So, you know, before long, we're going to be looking at $35 and $40 silver, and that bag is going to be $45,000 or $50,000 as we move forward. And, yeah, it's going to just continue like that. So don't be surprised.
Hmm.
Great way to store money, you know, put away silver coins.
Really? Yeah. And now, silver dollars are different, though, right? You don't sell those in bags. You sell
them
separately.
The only reason for that is the silver dollar production ended in 1935, although we were still making the quarters and dimes and halves up until 1964. So we stopped the silver dollar production 30 years earlier and made less dollars than we made the smaller coins. So a dollar, for example, an old silver dollar it carries now about 100% premium over its melt value. Whereas dimes and quarters and halves, they only carry maybe a 25% premium over melt.
What is that 100%? What does that mean, 100% premium over melt?
Well, let's say you took a silver dollar. Melted it. It has 0.77 ounces of pure silver in it.
Okay.
So it has roughly $20 worth of silver content, but you'd have to pay about $40 to buy one. So in other words, the price for a silver dollar is about 100% over the amount of metal content. But if you take a quarter dime or half dollar, you know, they're about 20 to 25% over the melt value.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Fred, I know you got to go. You're a busy guy. And folks, if you'd like to talk to Fred, his number is 800-878-2646, 800-878-2646. Who's there in the office with you, Donna? You and Donna?
Donna, Roger. Yep, we have a full staff here, very qualified people. Any one of us can help. So feel free to give us a call. We're all well-experienced, well-informed, and happy to help educate people on, you know, how to do this, why to do it, how to do it properly, and then, of course, physically provide the product directly to you.
And you're able to take time with people to understand what they want, what their goal is, right?
You know, that's part of the kind of the way we separate ourselves from a lot of the other people in the industry. I'm a firm believer in the educational side of this. It's just fundamentally important that people understand the nature of the monetary system as much as they want to.
Sure.
But yes, we do pride ourselves on that part of the process.
A boutique. It's a boutique coin company. All right, Freddie, you guys have a good day. Say hi to Don and Roger. You take care.
Will do.
You taking your sulfur now? Are you taking your sulfur?
I did this morning. I take it regularly, religiously, every morning.
We got Fred hooked.
Sometimes we get to do it at night, but I do it every morning at
least.
Good
for you. All right, brother. I love you. Thanks for your being here. Appreciate it. Take care of yourself. All right?
Great to be with you. Good to see everybody out there in, I used to say TV and radio land, but what are we now? Worldwide web land.
Web land. You take care of yourself. See you soon, Fred.
See you soon, Patrick.
Bye-bye. Fred Deshefsky, Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. Good man. Fred, partner with Andrew Goss before Andrew had the nerve to leave us almost 3 years ago now. We've been finding some old vintage Andrew shows that are just brilliant. And we actually played one this morning from the day that Lehman died. And we're going to be finding more of those and play those from time to time. It's a great education. If you'd really like to pony up and learn more about the monetary system from Andrew Goss, who used to be Fred's partner before he left, you can go to OneRadioNetwork.com, click on past shows by subject, and click on the real world of money. And we have shows going back to 2008 with Andrew Goss. And you can just download them and listen to them in the car, burn the CD, or I don't know if people even do that anymore, MP3s, and just learn about the monetary system. It's a fascinating subject, and I've learned so much from Andrew and Fred over the years, and very grateful because I have a sense of how it all works. And I think it takes, a great deal of the angst and any kind of fear about it away, because you kind of understand and you kind of have an idea of, you know, what I can do here. I saw where El Salvador just made, did you see this? El Salvador just made Bitcoin a legal tender. Crazy. They're actually, mandating that businesses in El Salvador have to take the Bitcoin if you want to give them Bitcoin. It's actually a legal tender. So the whole Bitcoin thing is interesting. We don't know where it's all going or if the boys are involved and they're going to try to explode it someday. A lot of the crypto people don't think they're going to be able to. But people are buying it because it's going up. So, you know, what can I say? We're going to talk to a fellow that has some interesting ideas about technology, about transhumanism, stuff like that, and just a social commentator, Jet Black. We're going to do that in about a half an hour. So if you'd like to stick around and come back, and we're going to take a little break, and be back at about noon Central Time, and then we'll be back on Friday to solve all the world's problems. I love you all very much. Thanks for your ongoing support. Check out Fred if you'd like to look into the world of gold and silver coins. Thank you for coming on our show and visiting some of our people that we talk about. You know, Shen Blossom and Sir Thrival and Aloe, El Mica and Dr. Cowan's products and Sauna and the Sulfur. If you'd like to get some Sulfur, you can go on our website. Whatever you like, we have a lot of really great products, and that's how you support us, by buying things that we recommend because we know these people. I love y'all. Thank you. May the blessings be. See you real soon.
We are listener-supported. One Radio Network.